And I've now turned the tape recorder on, and why don't we introduce Ted? Ted, tell people about yourself.
I'm Ted Balillis. I have a PhD in clinical psychology. But before I got my degree, I started teaching at Harvard Business School and taught at Harvard for about a dozen years in several of the graduate schools. I've started a couple of consulting companies along the way. Currently, I'm a partner in a firm called GH Smart. We work with 10 of the 10 largest private equity firms in the world and 150 others, including many alternative asset managers, hedge funds, and large global financial institutions. What do? I help private equity investors select CEOs to run their companies, basically select and develop their C-level talent. I work with CEOs and boards and investors really on everything that has to do with human capital. My belief is that if you have A players in leadership roles, you will be wildly profitable. And that's my story, and that's what I'm sticking to. And that's what I've stuck to for 22 years, and it's actually proved out to be pretty correct. So, well, as the evening goes on, we'll talk a little bit about what those selection methods are. How do you know who's going to make you the most money? How do you know when to switch someone out? How do you know what talent to put where? But that's basically what my practice is all about. I just flew in from New York. I spend the middle of every week on Wall Street, and that's where the majority of my clients are.
So Ted and I are both psychologists, I started my career as a clinical psychologist doing psychotherapy. Then I figured I can't make money doing this, and then I got a doctorate from Harvard in organization behavior. And then I was doing executive compensation for 4 years, and then I started my own business in 1979. So that was 33 years ago. Now I'm at a point nobody would hire me anyway. But that is the sort of attitude I bring to the business, an understanding of the clinical side of things, what makes people tick, how do people get motivated, an understanding of the organizational side of things, the system side, and then understanding the compensation side. The theme of everything that I do revolves around one theme, and that is smooth leadership change when the stakes are high. And there are three core services that Steibel Peabody does. The first is ensuring a smooth bench strength of talent. So we are known for doing CEO and CFO searches, plus we do board of director searches through Board Options, which is a separate company. Second is a smooth bench strength of leaders through coaching. And then finally, that company will have a reputation for treating people well, and so we get involved with helping people who are being out, helping them think about their careers, and executing on their game plan. We started in 1979. Today we're part of Arbora Global. We have 250 consultants in 25 U.S. offices in 32 countries. We just opened an office in Moscow. We work with 21% of the 100 companies named by Fortune magazine as best employers in the United States, 70% of the largest 20 law firms in Boston, 70% of the largest 20 healthcare systems in Massachusetts, and two of the big four CPA firms. And I write a column for Psychology Today magazine called Platform for Success. Also, if you go to HBR, I'm frequently in Harvard Business Review. And so this gets us to tonight. I'm working with Ted on a piece called When Leopards Change Spots. And the target market is Harvard Business Review. And I think it's reasonable that we'll get in. The idea is looking at board CEO power. And as that power shifts over 3 points in time. The first is the founder-dominated company. And for those of you who are in nonprofits, up until fairly recently, many nonprofits were founder-dominated companies. Then the next shift is the private equity-dominated company, which is where you're going to. And then the next is the public company. And again, as Ellen knows, there are even within the public company, there are variations of that, because a small-cap public company is not the same as a large-cap public company. But for purposes of this paper, we're looking at three varieties. If private equity was a newspaper, the headline, private equity company, private equity board fires the CEO, would be the moral equivalent to dog bites man. It happens so often, it's not even worth commenting on. It may be a big deal for the CEO's spouse, but it's within the private equity world, it's just, it happens all the time. On the other hand, CEO survives from founder-dominated company board to private equity-dominated board to public board. That headline is as rare as man bites dog. And because it's so rare, I wanted to study it. I wanted to talk with CEOs who have made those transitions. What did they learn? What is their secret sauce? And what can they teach us about CEO survival? Which is why I've got the headline, When Leopards Change Spots. What I'm going to do is talk about some of the things I've learned so far, and then bounce it to Ted and let Ted discuss it from his perspective. And we've really only just very briefly just talked about this, so it's not like we've rehearsed an answer here. The way in which I have done this is worked through my own network to find CEOs who have managed to survive through through three iterations. And I found, much to my, I was pleasantly surprised to find I could find five. Maybe I'll find more because I'm continuing the journey, but I'm here to just to tell you what I've learned from talking to five people. And then later on, I'm going to show you some things that we're doing with some of our private equity clients to help CEOs be more effective in working with private equity boards. Lessons learned. Lesson number one. Structure comes before process, because the CEO's ability to distort reality is great. I'll repeat that again. Structure before process, because the CEO's ability to distort reality is monumental. There's a new book, or it's not new, it's about a year old. It's a book about Steve Jobs. I don't know how many of you have read the book about Steve Jobs. So what is Steve Jobs' reality distortion? Anybody know? What that was? What was it?
Well, he would always paint a very positive picture the way that he would see it, but it really had nothing to do with reality.
But he could turn it into reality, and that was why it was a reality distortion field. He could paint a reality that did not exist, and then somehow by magic, it would exist. And that's every founder's great strength. And actually, if you ask the founder what your epitaph would be, that would be it. I created a reality that didn't exist. I willed it. And that is every entrepreneur's great strength. But the dark side of that also exists, and that is they can distort reality when it's objectively not true, and it worked to their detriment. And again, let's talk about Steve Jobs. There is a point where he goes to the board and is trying to stage manage the firing of John Sculley. Not only is he not successful in doing that, he himself gets fired. So the question is, he distorted the votes that he was going to get on the board so much that he thought he had this in his pocket, and he didn't. This was another example of reality distortion. And to one degree or another, I find that CEOs that I work with do that all the time. And that's a given. What I am finding in the CEOs that seem to be effective is that they understand that about themselves. And they compensate with a structure. They don't change themselves. they create a structure to compensate for this weakness. And I'll give you some examples. One of the people that I met is a CEO, and he had a general counsel that he totally trusted. And it turns out that this general counsel, before becoming general counsel of the company, had also done legal work for one or two of the partners on the board. And so he was in a position of trust on both sides. So the general counsel's mandate was to talk with every board member 3 weeks before the board. Ostensibly to go through any details, did you get the package, you know, is your hotel resident, but really to really get a sense of what do you really think about the job the CEO is doing? What do you really want to talk about the next meeting? What are the issues that, you know, the CEO is not covering? And the general counsel's mandate was the CEO should never be surprised by what goes on in the board meeting. And because he had this structure in place, he never was. Another example of a structure before process was that at one private equity board, they went to the founder CEO and said, you can nominate one board member subject to the approval, our approval as a board. And that person on that board will be your person. And when we have a problem, we're going to go to that person. And we expect that person to go to you. And we expect that because you nominated that person, you understand that that person is in your corner and wants the best for you. And so you'll listen to that person as opposed to me, the chairman of the board of the private equity company. So again, structure before process. I've seen CEOs use their coach for that purpose. And again, the idea is I tend to distort reality. I tend to be optimistic. That could be my failing. When I walk in this board, there should be no surprises. So a coach would do a sensing of the board members before the board meeting. And the idea was the CEO walks in, knows exactly what's going to happen. Ted?
Well, I certainly agree around sort of the psychological dimension of the founder, kind of being imaginative, creative, imagining a new reality. And I completely agree with you, Larry, around, you know, structure as an important tool or lever. Let me give you an example of what we use as a structural tool, as opposed to maybe a coach or a confidant or whatever. We create something called a scorecard, which is a very, very simple, maybe deceptively simple document that says, what are the 7 or 8 key outcomes the CEO is responsible for year 1, maybe year 2? What are the outcomes? AUM under management, EBITDA, revenue targets, distribution channels, and we'll make those outcomes very, very specific. So in year 1, revenue needs to, EBITDA needs to go up, let's say, by 10%. Year 2, by 20%. CEO needs to turn over all C and 50% of the B players in the organization and install A players in the organization. Number 3, founder needs to transfer important, you know, understandings of the distribution channel and network of the organization such that we are realizing the following kinds of partnerships. So we write this down in terms of outcomes. Now the board chair or anyone from the board can sit down with the CEO and say, how are we doing against this outcome? How are you doing against that outcome? And it becomes very, there's no wiggle room there. And I don't mean it to sound punitive either, because there's a lot of room for praise in that. It's like, we agreed to these 7 things. You're halfway through these. You've checked these. These are already done. Struggling on the last one. Great. How can we help you with that? So completely concur with what you're saying, Larry. That's an example, the scorecard, if you will, which I use a lot with CEOs, and which, by the way, the board constructs with input from the CEO. So it's a very collaborative, living document and tool can also serve that function.
How about you? What's any reactions to this? Any experiences that you've had? Supporting, conflicting, anybody? Okay. The second thing I learned is, again, structure over process. Every CEO, which is like every individual, has weaknesses. But the thing that I learned, that the COs that seem to be effective don't try to overcome their weaknesses. They learn to structure around their weaknesses rather than try to overcome them. The best example that I've found was a president / CEO of a company that was now private equity dominated and was going through a rash of acquisitions in the United States. And the president / CEO says, "This is not my strength. I don't like doing this, and it's going to play to my weaknesses. What I really like is sales." And so he went to the board and said, "Here's the deal. I will give up being CEO. I will become president. I will move to Europe. I will focus on sales. You're going to hire a CEO to focus on business, on transactions." And that's what happened. The person became CEO. The president was president. And that's how it went for about 4 years until the acquisition cycle was over. And then that CEO was gone. The president came and took back the title president CEO. And it worked out really smooth because they knew why we're there. And again, what I learned is honor your weaknesses, stay close to your weaknesses. One CEO told me, stay close to your strengths, but stay even closer to your weaknesses. Know what they are. If you need a coach to tell you what they are, do it. But don't try to change your weaknesses. Again, this is a critical difference between a startup / founder and a private equity dominated kind of board. Because when you're in the small company startup founder space, you know, not only am I giving the speeches, but I went to Star Market and I got the sandwiches and the ice cream, and I'm going to clean up the room after. I got to do it all. I can't expect an infrastructure to do it for me. And a lot of startup guys, they grow up in that environment, and they continue to think they got to do it all. But if you've got the capital now that you can work around your weaknesses by compensating with structure, do so. Don't try to compensate by making yourself better.
So, not to be controversial, but why is that any different than the following? I mean, in the companies I've grown up with, one of the adages that I've grown up with work-wise is you hire the best people you can find
and
fit your weaknesses, right? Go get the A++++ in anything you think is your weakness, because at the end of the day, you know, that makes the whole team a lot stronger. And that isn't necessarily CEO. So I guess what I'm saying is that, to me, I've seen that in smaller, not VC-backed, because I think that's, you know, one person who's doing 85 jobs. But once you get some critical mass and up, you know, at all levels of management. So to me, that's not just the CEO. And I think it goes from critical mass companies all the way up to big companies, not just PE-based, not just private, also public.
I'm going to say yes, but to that. I agree conceptually to everything you just said.
All right.
What I'm interested in are those CEOs that manage to change their spots. So that in order to get their business to get to the point that's of interest to the private equity people, often they've got to do everything. Or they got to know how to do everything. They feel they have to be on top of everything. And somehow they're able to give that up and then go to the position that you've got. And it's difficult for the successful founder to do.
I would add to that, too, that a number of CEOs that I've worked with really are not clear about what their weaknesses are. Or maybe to put it a little bit differently, the strengths and weaknesses are dependent on the context. The context changes radically when private equity comes to town. They're far, as you all know, they're far less patient than the previous situation. And therefore, to some degree, the strengths and weaknesses of the CEO actually changes because the environment, the lens changes. And so I desperately dislike the term coach, but for lack, but since we don't have a better term, it really behooves anybody in that role to work with someone to thoroughly understand, given the new game in town, what are my strengths and what are my weaknesses, and then following on to Larry's point, you know, don't invest 6 months trying to fix your weaknesses. I mean, just usually CEOs do that by positioning other people that are good in those areas. But know what they are, because they actually may change over time.
And this gets us into an issue about what is the responsibility of the board to coach the CEO on weaknesses. And one of the things that I got, it's very, very clear to me, is the board can't do it, the board shouldn't do it. And it's dangerous if the board does it. Number one is the board's primary responsibility is review of corporate strategy, making sure the money is not misspent, hire the CEO and fire the CEO. And if you're in the business of hiring the CEO and firing the CEO, and then you turn around and try to be the CEO's coach, at the very least, it can create confusing messages. And at the end of the day, the CEO feels a sense of betrayal. It's a lot better to keep the communications really clear. The second is the board is not a boss. The board also has a fiduciary and legal responsibility to the investors that trumps the coaching role. So that's got to come first. Third is one of the worst things that I've seen happen is the private equity chairman of the board says, you know, Ted, I know this is a new role for you. You know, we want to be of help to you. I'm here to help you. Call me if you need me. I got a plane to catch. See ya. Private equity people are incredibly busy people, and they live on planes, and often they're on 7 boards, and they're trying to do deals. So number one is most CEOs won't spontaneously call the chairman and use him as a coach. But even if they did, the private equity guy's not there. He's too busy.
Ted? This is the world I live in. I mean, I work with dozens and dozens of private equity companies, and I coach dozens and dozens of CEOs, and that's precisely my function, not the investor's function. And you know, I'm employed in that way for a reason. The private equity investors shouldn't be having those kinds of conversations for lots and lots of reasons, some of which you mentioned. And there needs to be a fig leaf, if you will, for the CEO to kind of protect himself or herself from the investors and have some privacy and have some kind of individual confidant that they can work with. So by all means, it's just a very bad idea. Well-intentioned investors may say, call me anytime. That's just a huge mistake. There needs to be a separation between the board and the CEO. It's there for a reason.
Any reactions around the room? Any experiences around the room?
Should there be two scorecards then, perhaps? A scorecard for the individual CEO and a scorecard for the CEO's team, if you like, so that there is some element of what you were saying.
You're exactly right, Bill. What we do is we construct an organization scorecard. So really, what are the big business outcomes that's going to make the enterprise successful? And then on atop that is the CEO scorecard, which is what does the leader need to do to realize these things? You're absolutely right. And that takes the subjectivity out of it. It takes a lot of the personality issues out of it. A corollary to structure before process is role before personality. So, you know, a major private equity firm comes to me and says, we have 3 external candidates for CEO of our $7 billion investment in this company. Interview the 3 people and tell us who's going to make us the most money. The board's already fallen in love with a favorite candidate or two. The scorecard method and the interview method that we employ helps protect from that whole falling in love process. One very, very quick story. The founder of one of the largest private equity firms in the world was going public and came to me and said, I need a new CFO. My CFO is great, but he's not the right person for a publicly traded company. He put 4 candidates in front of me, and I assessed them all and selected the one that I thought would be best, which did not comport with his opinion. jumping ahead, that's the person that was hired, and that's the person that's been most successful in the job. And again, I think separating personal feelings from what does the job actually require from the individual is hugely important. That would be my version of structure before process, role before personality. Yeah.
What I'm hearing from you, it sounds like you're weighing heavily on objectivity, putting emotion and subjectivity more
precisely
at bay, if you will.
Objectivity and business results. And just to complete the story, when I do interview and assess individuals, I'm doing a chronological walkthrough of what they've accomplished in their careers. So that's the data, that's the objective data that we're putting up against the future requirements of the role.
Any other reactions, comments? Okay, so lesson number one, structure before process. Lesson number two, structure before process. Lesson number three, timing is everything. If you're the CEO of a private equity dominated board, do not try to make changes when business is weak. I mean, I'm talking about changes of your management style and how you do things. Because when business is weak, there's almost nothing you can do to convince the board that things are okay. They are extraordinarily sensitive to their fiduciary responsibilities, and their fiduciary responsibility trumps any loyalty they have to you, or it should trump any loyalty they have to you. So going to the board and making management style changes when things are wrong is the wrong thing to do. The time to go to the board and make management changes is when things are going right. So, for example, in the case of the president CEO who said, let's split the role, I'm going to go to Europe, I'm going to run sales from Europe, you hire somebody else, he could never do that under conditions when business was weak. But he could do that under conditions when business was strong, and then he would be seen as a strong leader for making that suggestion. But if he made the same suggestion when business was weak, it would just reinforce the idea that he's weak. And he doesn't have confidence. Another example, I'm now working with a private equity company, and the chairman of the board of this private equity dominated company what happened was we were hired to do a CFO search. We did. The chairman is extremely pleased with the CFO and said, you know, we now finally have an A player as CFO, and that's made me sensitive that we have a B player as vice president of sales. So he's told the CEO, change the VP of sales. And then he's told me to tell the CEO to change the VP of sales. And the CEO has said, business is down, but I think it's down because of the economy and because of the business cycle, and it's going to come up anyway, no matter what we do, at a later point. When the business cycle comes up, then I will make the change. But if I make the change when the business cycle is down, then it will just be perceived by the chairman that I succumbed under the pressure. I have to do it in my own time, and the time to make the change is when I don't need to make the change. To make the change when I need to make the change is going to make me perceived weak in the eyes of the private equity guys. I think he's right. Ted?
Yeah, no, I would, you know, strongly agree with that. Timing is everything. I would also add, too, going back to an earlier point, that I would say there's a fourth function of the board, particularly with private equity-backed clients, and that is to confirm that the right talent is on board. So what I do at least twice a year with my boards is do a talent review. And it's, again, simple, but it's very, very straightforward. What are the critical roles? What are the roles most critical to the strategy? Do you have an A, B, or C player in those roles? You know, put your grade on the table and then defend why that person's an A, B, or a C. Yeah.
I assume that you're using your scorecard or a version thereof to do that as well?
Exactly.
I'm curious about your scorecard. In your scorecard, I think we've all seen scorecards, and some are rating, if you will, 1 through 10, whatever that may be, across a given score. And I'm assuming it comes up with on the aggregate, a risk profile of that individual or team. Mm-hmm. And there's another end, if you will, where you're actually doing evidence-based metrics. where you're actually correlating different factors together that may or may not be directly related to that person, outside factors that are out of their control, and how they manage that. How does your scorecard work?
Well, I think you're taking it to a much more sophisticated level. So that's where we talk about environmental factors. You're talking about things that the individual can control and things that they cannot control. Our firm is predominantly weighing in on the factors that the individual can control, and then through dialogue with the board, what are the exogenous factors that might happen? So that's when it becomes more qualitative, I think, than quantitative.
Kevin?
So, question. I understand and agree in many ways your point about the best time to make change is when you don't have to make it. It's like raise cash when you don't need it, right? Okay. But now you're the CEO. Bad things have happened. You need to get to that good place. So, if you were going to give somebody guidance on it, you know, things aren't going well for whatever reason. It could be the economy, it could be the business, it could be the paradigm shift. Name any question, any points you want to make. How is it best, in your experience, to position the changes that you might still need to make, not in an optimal time? Because things still have to happen, and you can't always time them.
Mm-hmm. Can I punt on that and get to that later?
No. Okay.
There was another question too.
I think mine is similar to yours because my experience with the portfolio companies is that usually, you know, and you also agree to that, that time is in short supply. And the PE firm is very results oriented. So, I understand, that it's also very good to make changes from position of strength. But sometimes, you don't necessarily have the time to wait for it.
I think that's where, again, going back to the scorecard notion, sort of the ultimate sort of plan, if you will, in terms of what we're looking for in terms of outcomes. If you can say, look, the change is really going to affect items, three and four, it's really going to, double our size or extend our reach, even though times are bad, I think justifying the change based on the objective plan that was preset gives you some leverage and arguing power, if you will, to make a change at a controversial time.
Let me deal with Alan's question.
They're connected.
Mm-hmm. Years ago, Alan, when you were vice president and CFO of Sonus, you retained us to do a search for tax. Beth. And if you remember that as part of the search process, I put you through an exercise called How to Manage Ellen Ritstone.
Yeah.
I asked a series of questions, and then we had a successful candidate named Beth, and we said, your ability to be successful depends in part on your ability to manage Ellen Ritstone. You're pretty smart. You'll eventually figure it out, but just to save some time, Here's How to Manage Ellen Ritstone, written by Ellen Ritstone. Now would you write How to Manage Beth and give it to Ellen? And this comes from my experience one day being a coach to a president of a hospital. And I was waiting in his office, and I had a BlackBerry at the time. And he walks in the office, and I'm reading the BlackBerry manual. And he laughs at me, and he says, "Aren't you smart enough to figure out how to run a BlackBerry?" And I said, I am smart enough to figure it out, but it's nice that they gave me a manual so that I don't have to, waste time. I said, for example, you're going to hire a vice president of quality. The person's going to travel all the way across the country, move in to where you are. You're going to, on the first day of work, they're going to walk into your office, and you're going to say, your ability to be successful depends on your ability to manage me effectively. Good luck.
But I think, Larry, I think ultimately my question, I think you probably said it better than I did, was time is short, you can't wait for everything's in the upswing. How do you make changes?
That's, I said I would get to it.
Oh, okay.
So the concept of how to manage me is part of our onboarding program. It's what we do every time we do a search. It's what every time we do finish an outplacement program. It's sort of like the sandwich in everything we do. Creating explicit how to manage me. So I went to some private equity people that I respect, and I said, if you were going to write a how to manage a private equity board, a manual that you would give to a founder CEO who's never managed a private equity board, what would you say? And the result of that is this document that's in front of you. Does everybody have a copy? I've got other copies of... So this was not so much written by me, but it was based on showing this to some private equity people that I trust and respect, and this is what they said. One of the things that I would recommend for private equity companies is that when they're bringing on a CEO, to try to minimize uncertainty and risk and doubt, and don't expect the CEO is instinctively going to figure it out, because by the time the CEO figures it out, credibility may have been lost and it's almost impossible to recover. So put together your own how to manage this board manual. And you can use this as a framework, because I suspect that most boards will be variations about this theme, not necessarily every board will be the same. Let me go through the things that I think are the most important for founders CEOs to understand about private equity dominated boards. Number two, nose in, fingers in. As Ellen is on the National Association of Corporate Directors board, one of the sort of cliches in NACD literature is nose in, fingers out. As a matter of fact, if you go to our website called boardoptions.com, you will see we have a whole section called nose in, fingers out. This represents the way boards should be. Ask the right questions, but you're not there enough to really run the operations. And if you're running the operations, then maybe you ought to be the CEO. Keep your cotton-picking fingers off the operations. That totally does not work with private equity companies. They will keep their nose in, they will keep their fingers in. You know, for example, I've got one client it's a private equity dominated company. There's an opening for vice president of HR, and one of the private equity people on the board said, I think you ought to hire Curtis to the CEO. And in a regular board, that would be just a gross breach, inappropriate. Not so in a private equity company. So nose in, fingers in. That's just the way it is. This gets to your issue, Ellen. Number four, bring us negative news as soon as possible. I think in a founder-dominated board, the founder has the option to defer giving the board negative news until the problem is solved. And most of them like to do that. And in many non-profit hospitals, where the hospital board members really don't really understand what's going on, the CEO wants to defer giving the bad news until the bad news has been solved.
That's why we're going through a merger.
And that doesn't work. Right. It doesn't work. If there's bad news, don't wait until it's solved. Bring it to the board now. They want to know now, and they will be very angry if they don't know about it as soon as possible.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, we have a saying, because in my previous life I worked a lot with private equity, and it's like, bad news don't get better with time. And it's because, they have vested interest, they own equity in the company, so it's really their money, you can't really play with it. So they want to hear it right away.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those counterintuitive things. If you read this in this room at this time, it sounds obvious. But if you're a CEO in the game, it does seem counterintuitive. You know, there's a problem. I can fix this. And I'd rather wait so I can say to the board, here is a problem, we got it resolved. Give me some time to fix the problem. And our role is that, no, you got to talk to the board now.
And by the way, at risk of stating the obvious, private equity investors really prefer CEOs that have been in other private equity-backed companies before. It's a huge premium precisely for this reason. They've learned these rules. They know the game. And in fact, one deal I worked on recently with a client, the CEO of the company that was being purchased by the private equity firm had been backed by another private equity firm before, and that was just huge. Number one, it gives them a chance to check references on the individual, so they can call their brethren in the private equity world. But more importantly, that CEO has kind of learned and internalized these rules. They know what they're getting.
Related from four is number six. We come across like we expect perfection all the time, but we really don't believe anyone can achieve it, even us. If you make an error, disclose it as soon as possible. Tell us what you learned. Tell us what you learned, and don't blame others. You're the one with the accountability. I find if you really want to piss a private equity person off, blame somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely.
You might be able to do that once if you've got credibility. You can't do it twice. You've got to say, I screwed up, buck stopped with me, here's what I learned. You will get respect. You may not keep your job, but you will get respect. If you blame others, you won't get respect and you won't keep your job.
I don't think I would ever use the word humility in the context of private equity investors speaking generally, but there is a strange kind of humility that they show and they expect from their management teams, which is this notion of admit when you're wrong. Ultimately, what private equity investors seem to believe in is that meritocracy is the ultimately, you know, fairest form. They perceive themselves to be a part of a meritocracy, and they want their management teams to be part of a meritocracy. And the worst thing you can do is to cover up or to blame someone else. So in that sense, you as a CEO, you get a lot more mileage, I think, with your board by saying, the mistake's on me. There's a strange kind of admiration that goes along with that.
Yep. And then that leads to number seven. If you say yes to our suggestions, you better mean it. We don't deal well with CEOs who tell us yes to avoid an argument and then implement a no. It's okay to push back as long as you've got evidence. In other words, if you're passive-aggressive, don't expect to last. They just do not deal well with passive-aggressive types. If you say yes, do it. If you don't say yes, then say no. And give a reason why no, but don't say yes and do no. Ted, any?
Yeah, no. It's again, I think meritocracy is sort of the watchword. It's, you know, do what you say and say what you're going to do.
The last one is number eight. And again, this gets us into the National Association of Corporate Directors, Holy Grail. There are two core responsibilities of a board. One is audit and oversight, and the second is advice and counsel. And when you're dealing with the founder-dominated company, the balance is shifted to advice and counsel. And indeed, in many of the less sophisticated nonprofit human service organizations, and your community service organizations, it's a lot of it is advice and counsel, and being of help and getting your hands dirty. Now that you're in a private equity, the default is audit and oversight. What have you done? Let's review. We have an accountability, we have fiduciary accountability to our investors. What have you done with their money? So the default has now shifted to audit and oversight, which means that unless the CEO specifically says to the board, I want you to take your audit and oversight hat off, and now I need your advice and counsel hat, they're not going to do it. Again, one of the things that I find during the sales process, the private equity people will say, not only are we giving you money, but we're giving you the advice and counsel from our years of experience. And then once they come in, it's all audit and oversight. And the CEO doesn't want to ask their advice and counsel. And that's a mistake. But there's a way to do that. And again, one of the ways that I have found is specifically say to the board, I want you to put your audit and oversight hat away. I want you to put your advice and counsel hat on. And then when that's done, then they put their audit and oversight hat again. Again, structure before process.
Yeah. No comment. I agree.
Any reactions?
I hear three things what you're sharing. It's transparency, accountability, and third one, I hope I'm going to get it right, is treat the private equity firms like experienced business partners and keep regular contact. The 24 hours you mentioned in here is a long period of time if something went wrong. Mm-hmm. Versus maybe a board meeting that, if you weren't private equity focused, could be another month or whatever.
Right.
You know, I've seen a lot of situations where there's been a lot of tension and conflict, and I've also seen situations, as many of you have, where things go right. And that's why a lot of CEOs will do their, you know, they should do their due diligence on their boards, because different private equity companies behave differently with their management teams. But I think that first word that you mentioned, transparency, is absolutely critical, and it's so different than a public company CEO where there's more ritual, there's more process, there's more ways of, well, we'll get to that later, or we won't raise that at this board meeting, we'll get to the next board meeting. I mean, my goodness, I mean, everything is real time in private equity, and it's yesterday. So, yeah.
What's the frequency of board meetings? How often are the formal meetings?
It depends on the private equity firm. They could have informal board meetings every week. Yeah.
How do you manage?
Yeah. I mean, when I say informal, I mean they're touching, you know, what are the numbers this week? I mean, it depends on the situation.
Maybe they're product management, that if they're involved with, I know this is gray, foggy line between boards and management sometimes, mm-hmm. but if they're involved that much in the company, you're really part of the management de facto, I would say.
There are plenty of situations where the particularly with the financial, the CFO, or the financial horsepower isn't where it needs to be, and the private equity firm will basically be serving, I would say, go so far as to say serving that function. Don't take that too literally, but they'll be, particularly with firms that are very supportive of management, and there are firms that are very friendly towards management, that's when you get that kind of situation. Yeah.
Two things. One, earlier you mentioned about managing all rich stuff, and what came to mind for me was rather how to, if you will.
It's not easy, let me tell you.
I thought that was a nice corollary that maybe you do that with the private equity firms before engaging a CEO, is how to manage the private equity firm before the CEO comes on board.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing was about transparency, is everybody sees transparency, that word different, and it comes down to that risk profile that you, from your experience, or what you're seeing in front of you, and how you manage that transparency, if you will, for each person on that private equity board. Mm-hmm. So how do you define transparency in relation to their contract?
I do a lot of speaking and a lot of workshops with CEOs of portfolio companies within one firm. So, you know, think of a major private equity firm. They'll always bring their CEOs once a year together for some kind of event. It's at that kind of event where we talk about talent, or we talk about development, or we talk about succession planning. We talk about transparency too. What are the expectations of the firm, of the managing directors of the firm, and how does that get played out? And it's a wonderful environment, because now CEO can talk to CEO, portfolio leader to portfolio leader, about what it's like to actually be, you know, in the portfolio of this company. So it's very much depends on the company. Those definitions are defined differently depending on the companies.
You know, maybe the skunk at the lawn party, which is something I've done for 25 years. At Providence Equity Partners, I mean, we would be friendly with the CEO, but when things started going tough, we weren't afraid to make decisions quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We moved people, and even go down as far as to say, look, you've got to get rid of that CFO, you've got to get rid of your,
sure,
your CIO, your, mm-hmm, VP of sales, whatever it is. You know, so maybe we were more Darth Vader-ish than others. Private equity firms, I don't know, but
no.
we didn't waste any time when it came time to, you know, move somebody along. And we also had a cadre of people that, you know, when we saw a company getting into trouble, we put somebody in there.
Right.
You know,
that's pretty typical.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty typical.
But I guess, I mean, some of the flavor that I've gotten from the conversation is that, you know, particularly the comment about, you know, things are going tough. You know, or you're falling on hard times and you need a fix, and it could be perceived as a weakness if the CEO doesn't replace VP of sales or whomever the problem may, rightly or wrongly, be attributed to. We would expect some sort of movement, not just, oh, let's wait 6 months to see what happens. You don't have 6 months. This is the point was made earlier. We have advisory board meetings every 6 months with our top LPs, and we have to tell them what's happening in the portfolio company. And we're not going to sit there and say, well, you know, things aren't going so well.
You're absolutely right. Our assessment reports, because we actually produce assessment reports on management, get bound right into the books. And distribute it to, you know, to the LPs, you know, with our clients. I mean, action is required immediately. Good firms do that. Good firms like yours do that. Other firms don't, and they're not quite as successful.
I will agree with you, and I'll go back to what Ted said about context. In the example that I gave, which is my client, the private equity is a small player. They're playing with their own money, and they're the only private equity on the board.
Mm-hmm.
The CEO, the company's it's about a $70 to $80 million company, so it's small. It's manufacturing. And the CEO and the chairman of the board, who is the managing partner of the private equity company, have worked together for 10 years. So he's got the creds to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I was the CEO of a $500 million company and I've got Providence Equity and Blackstone on the board, I've got about 5 minutes to do what I've been instructed to do. And that gets us into another issue which I did not cover in my research, and that is the experience that I've had and Ted's had of you walk into a private equity dominated board. And there are splits within the board. The thing that I see is there's old Fred over here, and he's managing partner of this $150 million small potato private equity company. And there's Bruce over here, who's 26 years old from Harvard Business School, doesn't know shit about the industry, but he happens to be with Blackstone, and he thinks his shit smells sweet. And these two people, the testosterone between these two guys starts flowing, and they start playing tennis with the CEO.
And or just you know, the whole notion of club deals. Providence Equity is a part of many, many club deals. So you've got these behemoth, you know, private equity investors, each one kind of with billions that have been invested, and now the poor CEO has to kind of manage not really one board, but really kind of three boards, three sponsors or more. And that's a daunting, daunting task.
Any other questions? Well, thank you. We will have our next meeting next month, last Thursday of the month. It'll be July. And our guest is going to be the managing partner of the New England region for Grant Thornton, and he's going to be talking about trends in audit committees. So hope to see you there. Thank you. Please feel free to stay and schmooze and feel free to go out in the hallway, have a cup of coffee, grab some more soda and sandwiches before you leave. Thank you very much for coming.